I'm confident that many of you here today may be more talented and experienced in the area. Yeah, there's a seat over up front here. In the area of visiting, and it's probable that a number of you will have some thoughts to share that will help us all today, and I hope you will do that. At the same time, I think you're like the general public. There are a number of you who still are bothered with, well, I would do it, but I'm not sure what to say. I think more recently of a funeral, the daughter, about 25 years old, of a fellow council member and his wife at church. And the funeral happened to be held in the Catholic Church in Eugene. And I was there and starting down the aisle, and a lady to the left of me kind of mumbled something like she didn't know what to do. And I said, well, I really don't either. Let's sit down together and we'll figure it out. And during our conversation, she said, Marianne's mother and I have been like sisters during our lifetime. I hope I don't meet her today. And what she was really saying, and she said, I don't know what I would say to her. How would I really talk to her, you see? And so it's probably another example of what I don't know what to say there. I have a few things I wish to share first. The purpose, as I thought, was to all who seek to accept Jesus' invitation to visit the lonely and the hurting, but who feel inexperienced and unqualified. And then, as an introduction, this is an actual experience. This book started with Sherm. Happened to be Sherm Mowry of our church. We served together on the church council, where I admired his straightforward approach to issues. Candid, open, frank. Later, Sherm became ill. The diagnosis was cancer. I wanted to visit him, but I really didn't know what to say. Yet Sherm's candor in relationships with his friends encouraged me to approach him the same way. I drove to his home for my first visit. My thoughts were, maybe Sherm will be at the doctor's office. You know what I'm saying, huh? But he was home, and I think that he discerned my difficulty. Sherm, I said, I need your help. I don't know what to say when I come to visit a friend who is sick. How about becoming my teacher in this area? Sherm and I are both in the field of education, and that was another tie. Thus began a deeper, genuine relationship that influenced my life. Our talks were memorable because, like Sherm, they were without pretense. He proved to be an able teacher. But I do have one regret. The experience of praying with a sick friend also was a new venture for me. Sherm knew I was praying for him. Yet I determined to pray with him at my next visit. When I returned from several days out of town, however, it was too late. I had deferred too long and Sherm was gone. I wonder if, first I guess I would say this. The ideas, most of the good ideas in this book come from fellow strugglers, other people who have had problems with illness, with bereavement, with divorce, and with imprisonment. And I owe a lot to other people for what's in here. In fact, 2 years ago at this time, we had several sessions at Holy Village on, you know, what is helpful and unhelpful when visiting these people in trouble. I think maybe some of you were here. Anybody here at that time? I see several hands. Okay, well, you particularly then know the background and our due appreciation. I'm going to today deal not in the area they're listed here, but deal with bereavement or death first, then divorce. They're more traumatic in some ways, and probably less understood, at least in divorce area. And then if we have time, you know, into the imprisonment and illness. Let me ask you first, in the area of bereavement, what might somebody suggest to us that might be one of the most helpful things you can do when a friend has lost a spouse?
Go and be with them.
Good. Okay. Go and be with them.
Show them that you care.
And show them that you care by your going and being with them. Okay. Good.
Listen to them.
And listen to them. Right.
Many times just break down. Things that you can do for them.
Okay. Things that you might be able to do for them. It's interesting, if we stop to analyze, these comments that have been made so far have absolutely nothing to do with what was once thought to be the title, do they? You know, but I don't know what to say.
You don't have to say anything. Yeah. Take your hand and put your arm around me. And if it's been a long illness, let's say it's a blessing.
Can we pull out a little bit more on the let's say it's a blessing, huh? What do you mean by that?
Well, I have a very dear young friend who 3 years ago had an unoperable tumor in the brain. She cannot lift her head. She hasn't been able to feed herself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if she could go with that hope before I get home, I would tell her mother and her father that say it's a blessing, she does not have to suffer.
Okay.
I understand. You don't have to be suffering with her, because they are. They're suffering along with her.
Okay, and
she's
suffering
in
and
condition.
Yeah, suffering and vegetating and things like that are not a blessing. Okay. What? Yes.
Sometimes it's, even though they've gone through a long period like that, at that moment, they don't see it as what it's a separation, it's a shock, even though it was expected.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure that at that time they will see it as what it is.
Yeah. I think you're right. I agree with that. One more.
I always tell them that I'm going to miss them too. And I mean it. And we have a severe friend out there. I usually say, I'm
going to listen to it. Okay, what might be some of the least helpful thing, or what might be a least helpful thing you can do in the case of death?
Okay.
That's a point that it's so easy to say, I know how you feel. And even if I have been through it, I'm not in your shoes, I'm not in the same relationship as you were with somebody, and I can't possibly know exactly how you feel. Strange as we may think, that's a good point.
Well, I think this is funny. I heard this when I first married. The banker had a partner next to his dad died. And this lady was a little bit scatterbrained. They did it on the harvest. There was a little scatterbrained. He came up to the cemetery and he shook his hand and said, congratulations. And he was about to die.
Yes. That would be a little hard to accept. We can't top that. Maybe we should move on from that. Well, again, though, I think in thinking about it, that person was probably kind of at a loss to know what to say and very ill at ease, and something came out that was not anticipated. Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm going to share a few things from the portion that when there is death, and you have mentioned some of these. Part of it, we start this way. We learned of our foster son's death on Friday. A fellow church member about our son's age heard the news through the prayer fellowship that we have in our church. Early Yeah, early Saturday morning, our doorbell rang. Our friend stood on the porch holding a bouquet of pink plum blossoms and yellow daffodils. "I'm sorry about your son," he said as he handed me the flowers. He'd come in a truck from about 10 miles away. "I brought my wheelbarrow and shovel to help move the load of chicken fertilizer from the driveway to your garden." I don't recall much he said in words that morning. A little emotional for me. But I'll never forget what he said in his actions. His kindness embodied God's loving care in our time of need. And then we go on, you know, how often we neglect the distress of the bereaved because we don't know what to say. Then about verbal communication at the time of death. A friend who has lost a loved one needs to talk. This is essential to working through grief. We are simply to listen in love and affirm our continuous caring. We needn't be fearful whether we say the right thing. Our presence at their time of distress speaks of our sincere concern. A very dear friend, I was with him at the SWA in Eugene, chairman of our church council. He worked hard on the exercise machines and looked too hard, I guess, and he died right there. I went with to the hospital, and then I must admit, for one of the first times, I said, "I'll go to Gertrude's home." And there were three of us there, and she was in the kitchen, and we sat around the table. She served us some coffee, and we just talked. We just thought she'd listen. She might participate. She might not. But she said later, you know, just having some people there was very, very important as far as she was concerned. I don't think she remembers much of what was said, but she remembers the presence. Yes, also, I don't know how you feel about, and I'm sure many of you are very experienced in this, but is it easy for you to talk to other people who've lost a spouse and mention the name of the spouse? There's some of us who have a little difficulty because we say, well, that will, you know, bring up memories that are sore and hurtful. Someone indicated this to me or said this, "Thanks for making my day so much brighter." This is a widow who had talked with someone else. "I don't understand why, but people never talk to me about Matt. They think it will make me feel sad. But what wonderful memories it brings. It makes the sorrow of his absence a little less." So I have learned from that too. And when I see Trudy, we go out to breakfast, Lois and Trudy and I, or something like that, and we talk about her. And just a very natural, normal thing now. But for me, for many times, it was not. One of the problems about working with bereaved people is the tendency for some of us to bestow advice when it's not requested. And I've heard people very willingly say, "Oh, you know, you ought to sell your house now. You know, or you ought to, whatever. You ought to do something with your children or whatever." And there's certainly maybe a time, but if requested, that advice might be helpful. And then, as you said earlier, something about don't say that I've had the same experience and I know exactly how you feel. It's better, I think, to say I've had maybe a similar experience, but I really don't know how you feel. But I care about you, and that's why I'm here.
I had a brother-in-law. His 22-year-old daughter had taken her life by carbon monoxide, leaving two small children. He had gone to his other daughter's home, and the wife and I reached him there. And when I approached him, I threw my arms around him and said, "Now she's with Jesus. Now she's with Jesus." Did I say the right thing?
I feel positively toward that. I don't know how the rest of you feel. Any reaction?
I think we can't judge the suicide because they could be out of their mind.
Yeah.
Yep. So I think we've got enough to God. And knowing the loving forgiveness of Christ, he happened to be a reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints member.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the only thing that could come to my mind at the time.
Yeah, I think two things. You know, you're being there. You're putting your arms around him, and you're saying what was important to you at the time. I don't know what else you can do. I don't think we can stop and analyze and say, how will somebody react if I say such and such?
Well, it seemed to help them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, someone said also that it's helpful, I think, a lot of times, for someone grieving to say, you know, if we could see Jesus at your elbow now, he would probably be weeping too. I like the little story that kind of illustrates the importance of just being with a friend and maybe not having to say anything. It was of a 5-year-old girl whose dearest friend had died, another little girl. On her return from visiting her friend's mother, someone asked her what she had said. "I didn't say anything," she replied. "I just sat on her lap and cried with her."
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a letter to Dear Abby. "A widow emphasized that those who did not come to visit," I'm sorry, "a widow emphasized that those who did come to visit really ministered to her in her sorrow. On the other hand, she interpreted the actions of friends who made no contact as an, quote, I don't care feeling. Her advice to those unsure of what to say is that a simple, I'm sorry, is sufficient. Believe me," she continued, "your face and your eyes express the feelings you can't put into words." To her, the most meaningful communication came in the form of hugs, as someone has said, pats on the shoulder, squeezes on the hand, together with the statement, "I just don't know what to say." They didn't realize, she concluded, that they had already said it all. I think of this, I don't know what to say sometimes as a, we don't want to be ignorant, so we may not say anything if we don't want to be ignorant. And I've been in education most of my life. When I was in public school work, I often had the feeling that I needed to have answers in school administration. People expected you to know these things, you see. It was quite a revelation when I went to the university campus, and quite a relief to find out that most professors pride themselves in ignorance outside their own little specialty. You know, you might say, well, you're a biologist, what about this? Or it might be a field of literature. Oh, I don't know anything about literature, I'm a biologist. Okay, here's a question in biology. Well, I'm a molecular biologist, you know, narrowing it down all the time. But there is something to, when you don't know, a real good feeling about saying, I'm ignorant there. A little poem by Dorothy Sue, H-S-U. I don't know if you've seen her book, Don't Say, or her poem, Don't Say, or not. It speaks to the bereavement issue. If I can, many people say this, if I can do anything, please let me know. Or call me if you need any help. And she says, don't say, if you need anything, call. I need all sorts of things, but I won't call. I'm not built that way. You call me. Tell me, I'll pick up the girls today. Tell me, Bob will be over to mow the lawn. Tell me, I'll help you clean today. But don't say, if you need anything, call. There are other helpful activities that correspond with Dorothy Sue's thinking. One person said, one of the things I really appreciated was someone asking if they could make some phone calls for me. I took care of the relatives and close friends, but there are some others someone else can take care of. Or if older persons have no car, offer to drive to the various offices he or she must contact. The elderly especially can use a lot of help. Another person said, on the day before my husband's funeral, a Mennonite lady who knew my husband in the hospital voluntarily came to our house to help with such things as ironing the clothes we were to wear, polishing the children's shoes, and so forth. I felt cushioned by her loving support. Another person wrote, three elderly friends came over the day before the memorial service and cleaned my house. They also served a potluck dinner after the service. Miscellaneous offers of supportive ministry include, I'll take your laundry home with me. Please phone me anytime you feel like talking. I'll go to the cemetery office with you. I'll stay in your house during the funeral. They didn't say, you know, and Tom didn't say when he came to our house, you know, or when he called and contacted us, call me if you need help. He came with some specific assistance. Any comments before I go on to post-funeral loneliness?
I'm sorry?
That does not help. Okay, on post-funeral loneliness, I've got one other thing that I picked out of the Idaho Statesman about a year ago. This was to Ann Landy. May I say a word to all the nice people who came to my husband's funeral and said such kind things as, please keep in touch. We don't want to lose you, too. And also said, if there is anything we can do, don't hesitate to call. Would you believe that when I ran into one of those gracious women in the shopping center yesterday, she said, the reason we haven't called is because we can't bear to see you without John. You are such a wonderful couple. The sight of you alone makes us sad. If those former friends who still have their mates knew what it is like to be suddenly left out of everything, they would behave differently. There are days when I have had my phone checked to see if it is still working. It seems incredible not to get a single call. Thank you for letting me unload. Very much a soul in Westchester. Very much a loner in Westchester. Well, then, along the same line, another person wrote, we were overwhelmed with food the first 2 or 3 days. We couldn't enjoy it all then. Later, nobody seemed to remember that you might not feel like fixing anything. Then a dish of food would be far more welcome. In a similar vein, another individual said, one of the strongest needs for me is not to have everyone disappear on me when I need them most after all the relatives have gone. Continuing, Sunday usually is the loneliest day of all. It is a family day and difficult one on which to be alone. One grieving person elaborated, "After my father passed away, my mother and I were alone at the house the following Sunday. We waited all afternoon for someone to come. It was a letdown. Nothing happened. Later, a number of friends reported, quote, 'We knew you would have a lot of company in the afternoon, so we didn't come.'" Another person who lost her husband shared the struggle she had returning to her family church. Good friends of ours, she became a fellow principal in Portland. She says, "Perhaps the most difficult adjustment I had was to continue attendance at my own church services. Now, I would have never thought of that. The thought of going into the building all alone, being alone when greeted, feeling unable to sit in the regular place, and wondering where to go for dinner afterwards seemed more than I could face. I still felt the need for church, so I went out of town to be with relatives. Or I took unchurched people and visited another church. Or I went to downtown churches, taking elderly people who normally listen to sermons on their home radio. Attending lectures, eating together, hiking." Then two couples invited me to our church retreat. Attending lectures, eating together, hiking, visiting, and so forth took me over the hump. I've been able to attend church ever since." And then other people indicated that not just, you know, on Sundays, but Christmas, other holidays, anniversary of the death, and things like that. It's difficult to be alone, and that's the time to phone people, take them out for dinner, and stuff like that. Okay, what else? Does this spark anything that you want to add before we move to another topic? There's something somewhere, but anyway, it generally suggests that I guess none of us will ever feel, in my opinion, that we have done everything we could do or have not done everything we couldn't do.
I think for Christmas, just before noon, you had a very young order that we have to let loose and things you remember that complicated.
Yeah.
And we'll always be unfinished business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we grow and change. I'm not the person I was 10 years ago or 20 years ago, and my wife will say, "Thank goodness." And, you know, I'm probably not the person I might be 10 years from now either. And so on that basis, if we know Christ's forgiveness, which is complete, as his acceptance, which is non-conditional, and such as that, that covers those situations. So it's hard to sometimes drop that. Interesting thing, I was working with someone a while ago, and I probably had some feelings somewhat along that line. And I said, in fact, it was this thing. I had this full of stuff, and I said, "Hey, what's the hold of this?" I said, "Now drop it." And just the physical letting go of something, you know, and dropping it wasn't an answer. But at least it was kind of an indication, "Hey, that's what you've got to do, and then don't pick it up again."
There's a common feeling of another common feeling is the person who the widow who has the medicine put on him and had all these problems inside. He finds something, you know, he's called on him, all these nobodies, the other car was properly, all these ways, put on him alone,
trying to face it. And I think that's a common thing to a student that they have.
Kind of being lost without the help. And the more years we've been married, I think the more difficult it is to be alone. Okay, I'd like to move ahead, if we can, to divorce. More and more people, whether we like it or not, are being divorced. We find more and more church members, whether we like it or not, are being divorced. We find more and more pastors, whether we like it or not, are being divorced. And strangely enough, the church has a ritual for baptism, for confirmation, for marriage, for death, and all that. There's nothing that goes along with divorce. It's kind of what? Tucked under the rug? Left alone? I'm not suggesting that there should be a church have some ritual for divorce, but I think we should recognize the fact that this is a traumatic event like some of the others. And it just happens, and no one necessarily recognizes it. One of our six members, a couple of families that we thought were very safe, had divorced a while ago. And I called one of the individuals, Linda. And I said to Linda one Sunday, she was also on a council with us, "I know you're divorced, Linda, but I don't know what to say now." And that was a few seconds. And it was almost, we were off in the corner after services. It was almost like I pulled a plug out of the diamond. She had much to talk about. She said, in effect, being divorced is often like sitting in a room with your friends and there's a white elephant or a big fireplace sitting there and everyone ignores it. No one mentions it. So she had a need to talk. As anyone who's under stress and problem is with having a need to talk. We tend, I think, to want to appear to, was it the Chaplain Joan, I think, this morning yesterday said, we wear a facade, a mask, you know, everything is strong, everything is all right, and yet behind it, there are a lot of hurting people, and we don't really give them a chance to share their hurt. Another young woman told me, after my divorce, some people treated me as if I had a contagious disease. It tore me apart. I already had feelings of guilt, shame, and failure. Three essence. What I desperately needed from others was some evidence of the good news in all things. Love, acceptance, and forgiveness. Then one friend said to me, "To me, you have not changed as a person. I still care about you very much." I thank God for that expression of caring. It was His love incarnate in the follower of Christ. Another person said, "I existed in a conversational vacuum for years because many did not talk to me or talk about my divorce." Another person commented, "Friends treated a significant event in my life like the white elephant I mentioned, sitting in a room. No one recognized it at all." Then someone here mentioned, "I don't know just how you feel." And they went on to say, "Trying to comfort a divorced person with, 'I know just how you feel,' did not help them." As one person declared, "Nobody knows just how you feel. And even if they did, the divorce experience can be so painful that I would resent them saying so. The psychological pain and guilt of divorce tend to make you crawl off into some dark thicket of your mind like a wounded deer. Granted, you need some solitude to listen to your emotions and thoughts, but the goal in befriending the divorce should be to help them heal and emerge. not to leave them to stiffen and die inside by poverty themselves in the thicket the rest of their days. A very graphic expression. After the companionship of a marriage, loneliness is the toughest adjustment to take. Similar feelings are expressed in a poem called Winter. The icicle spears drift constantly. You cry and cry and never seem to cry out the spring that begets the river of sorrow. The trees bend under their habit of white can only stand and stare in silent sympathy around them. And then some people assert and told me this, that they feel that divorce may be more difficult than death. Now, you know, you can argue this for a long time. But the frame of reference is this. After a death, you remember the good things about the person that's passed away. After a divorce, which is the culmination of many, a long time, of problems and strife usually, after that, you tend to remember the negative things. And then someone else said to me, divorce is a death that will not die. Every time you see a family again, it's another turn of the same feeling. So, you know, what is the church's responsibility to these people who feel they have failed, who feel they have a load of guilt and shame to carry? Well, someone said that when people don't say hello to them when they come into church after they're being divorced, they're rejecting them. Mm-hmm. You know, they just leave them alone. And so you're not talking to me because you think it's probably my fault or I've made a mortal sin or whatever it is. And then they say any rejection of that type only reopens the wounds of the rejection you've already experienced in raising the child. Church members need to unfold rather than judge those who have been cut off from marital companionship. Even if the person is at fault, and I don't know quite how we always know that, but even if that was the truth, the separated spouse is a bruised individual who hungers for someone's total acceptance. They're lonely people. And again, I can't say I'm quoting what other people tell me. One problem, relationships with friends and relatives, particularly on the spouse's side, dry up much faster than you think. And a quote, we soon become the odd person out, or we acquire the status of a fixed ego. Life has become a game of musical chairs. At social events, everyone else gets a chair, but you seem to be left standing alone. I said to her one day, because, you know, touching is a very helpful thing. I said, Linda, if I put my arms around you, I don't want you to misunderstand. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I don't know, but I've heard from some people that there are those in the world who might want to take advantage of the situation when someone has been lost a loved one and been divorced or something like that. And she said, oh, she said, that accounts for some of the changes in the reactions of other people. Mm-hmm. I might meet someone in a restaurant and he's one who used to come up, put his eye on me, and now when I meet him in the restaurant, he says, hello, Linda. And so there is that problem that she hadn't recognized that helped them in her understand why people might speak a little differently. So I have not given up
Yeah.
It's all going to
be fine. Yeah, but it's pretty difficult, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, another little poem here that from a friend of mine who had double divorces. The other little son, blonde hair, and in the recent divorce, the son went with the mother. And he titled this poem, Moving On. The last piece of furniture was carried out of the house this evening like a wounded soldier on a litter. And the house now is only a cluster of empty cubicles. My footsteps call out from the four walls as I turn one last time through the house. To see, this is his lost son, to see him, corn-silk hair and laughter flowing free as he scampers from room to room, I can hear the puppy barking in the field. My footsteps cry out again as I turn and walk out the door. Time can't be stopped. It keeps moving on, and the empty house has become my mind. He's gone. I've got some other things here, but any other comments in this area? You know, we may not be involved ourselves, we're often relatives that are involved. Anything you want to add that's helpful to others here?
I think this is a good enough to become involved in all the gossip that people want to do, right?
Because that often is blaming, judging, criticizing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They need understanding, love, and uplifting, that's it. And complete acceptance. Yeah.
I think that part of what we're going to realize is that we say divorce, but it never really happened. That continues to be contact, that takes with the children, and continues to be relevant, and those things can continue to affect themselves.
Right.
And then we can minister.
There's church before it happens, we may not know about it, and there's church after it happens.
Probably too late for the divorce person, and I think possible. It should be more sensation on the importance of what a marriage means. I think probably all of us will agree that the toughest contact that you ever engage in all your life, if you're going to make a joke. It is, it's a tough one. You're going to keep parties totally different into one home. Two separate sets of customers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's got to be a lot of difference there. And if it's going to be going one way and fixing the other, it's not going to work.
Ours did, and I'm afraid I was 60 and hers was 40 for a while. I've asked for forgiveness for that. But yes, you have to do it.
Maybe all 150 in romance, you know. And you never be a little practical, you're willing to make the contract work.
Uh-huh, a good point. Well, I want to quote one other from a person that I met here together. Well, someone said, first, I know you are hurting and I really care about you. Again, that's helpful. And I want you to know it. I'll listen to you. A divorced friend claimed this insightful approach was liberating because in effect someone told her, yes, your suffering is unique, it must be painful, I do care about you in the midst of it, and I'll gladly help you by then. Then she said, that communicates a willingness to walk beside me and listen and console and comfort me. In effect, my friend gets down in the pit with me. That's different from standing outside a pit and calling down to somebody, get out of the pit, or you shouldn't be in the pit, or don't you feel better because everything is going to work out for good now that you're in the pit? Those approaches are painful to the one who is already suffering. If I am in the pit, to console means for you to get down in the pit with me and declare,
I care about you. Or it may be more appropriate for you just to listen to me, to hear how it feels to be in a pit, how dreadful it is. Before I can heal, I must have an opportunity to express my feelings to someone. We hear many times about the ministry of listening, accepting and listening. I see some unusual, almost hard to believe statistics that a high percentage of people who go to psychiatrists would not have to go if they had somebody who would listen with acceptance and care and love.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, any of us can be involved in that. Yes, no, for ladies here, not that there is a, oh, I just left today. Have you heard of the Stephen Ministry?
Yes.
Out of ADLC.
Mm-hmm.
He says it's a very good program for training lay listeners and counselors in the congregation. Is that your experience?
Yes, I have the information on it at home, and I need them to take formal training.
Yes.
Come back and teach within their congregation.
Other people.
Yes.
FCETHM. Oh, you are. FCETHM.
Yes.
Yeah. And you feel it good.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, wow. Well, Stephen Ministry.
He said something about listening. My closest neighbor has in his team told me for us that Boston is good at being ministry. And just within a week, during the past week before we left campus, the 15th of August, I again heard for the umpteenth time in 15 years the story of the divorce, all the detail, all the things that are if you still were 15 years later. And I have listened, I used to try to counsel on certain, in certain areas. Now I do nothing but listen.
Mm-hmm. And apparently that's what he needs. That kind of substantiates the thought that someone gave us that death, I mean divorce is a death that does not die.
He said this. He even said this to a person that had just lost his life. He said, you can be thankful. You know where your life is. I don't.
That's very interesting.
That thing in the
Okay, let me wind up because I want to get you to dinner, and I appreciate all of the input. It's been very helpful. A friend endorsed this thinking, how much we need to be touched by others and how much we need, especially men, I mean, how much we men tend to ignore that. After being divorced and alone, I used to watch married couples touch each other's arms or squeeze each other's hand at the dinner table. I watch these natural automatic gestures like a half-starved orphan peering through a candy store window. You can't believe how wonderful an arm around the shoulder, a squeeze of the hand, or a good hug can feel when you're alone. A group of fellow believers is best equipped to offer this supportive, silent communion of love and concern. We've been holding many years, and we've talked about the hold and hug. I don't know if that's still very common around here or not, but I know when Carol Hinderly was here, that was a common thing. Okay, a couple of short statements here that I want to share. A statement from the preface, and then one from the summary, and we'll... Because we feel that we lack that experience and wisdom, and not knowing what to say, we often find excuses to procrastinate such ministries. One common rationalization is simply, I don't know what to say. But our Lord exhorts us to action with his promise. My grace is all you need, for my power is strongest when you are weak. And then from the summary, just a couple of thoughts. Probably not one of us will ever qualify in all respects as the ideal visitor. apprehension about personal visiting skills, Cardinal Newman's observation for it, where he says that nothing would ever get done if we waited till it was done so well that no one could find fault with it. This concept is reinforced by another thing. How silent the woods would be if only the best birds sang. And how void of friendships the lonely would be if only experts responded to their visitation needs. Okay, with that we'll, I have one thing else. If you want it, I didn't get around to it, but I have a handout that I used for another discussion, and it just has a summary of some of the points, not too many. And I'll leave these up here if anyone wants them. Otherwise, it's time to consider dinner, and I'll stay if anyone has individual questions.